folks, welcome back to Indaba Africa. This is Chris once again. Today, my special feature guest for my first live broadcast ever on Facebook, wow, something new, is Adrian Roos from the Democratic Alliance, a member of parliament in Gauteng province in South Africa. Khokhandit, how are you today? Are we frozen?
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you.
Okay. You were frozen there for a moment. Excellent. Well, you're a member of parliament for the Democratic Alliance, and you represent constituents there in the commercial heart of South Africa. But I think a lot of people be surprised to find that you actually have a fair amount of rural areas within the province.
Well, it's about 18,000 square kilometers is Gauteng. It is the commercial hub of South Africa. But actually a large amount of it, because of apartheid spatial planning, a large amount of it still has big farmlands in between the urban areas.
Now, I reached out to you to get a chance to interview you because I understand that you represent the area that includes Babsfontein, and that's where this elderly couple, Dufi Oosthuizen and Tas, were recently murdered in a farm murder. And so that's why I reached out to you. That, in fact, is part of your constituency, yes?
Well, from a parliament point of view, my constituency is a little bit to the north of that. But my role for the Democratic Alliance is also on farm murders. And so for farm murders, I cover the whole of the Gauteng province, which is a bit like a state in South Africa.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Babsfontein is inside that state, yeah.
Well, about 65% of my audience on YouTube is actually South Africa-based, about 20% here in the U.S., and the rest is from around the world. So we get quite a mix of folks. South Africans, of course, understand, but thanks for explaining that for our international audience, because some of them aren't familiar with the political setup in South Africa. But you're a member, of course, of the official opposition. It's the second largest party in parliament in South Africa, the Democratic Alliance.
Yeah, that's right. And certainly we've been busy. We have our budget speech tomorrow, and there's definitely a lot going on at the moment. You know, for us to bring fresh proposals to the table, you know, to help us, like any country, recover from the COVID crisis. And so we've been very busy in the last while.
Well, it's been quite a crazy situation in South Africa ever since the 27th of March last year, when President Ramaphosa announced a lockdown coming up, a 21-day lockdown. We're now into day, I don't know, close to 330, 340, something like that, of lockdown in South Africa. We saw a decline in farm attacks, according to AfriForum's, the civil rights group's statistics, which came out on the 17th of February, a decline from over 500 down to just under 400 attacks. But the number of murders were higher on rural attacks this past year, went from 45 in 2019 to 63, according to AfriForum. That seems to be a bit distressing. We noticed, if you watch statistics closely in events, this really picked up pace after the lockdown restrictions were eased in July. We saw a number of brutal murders in the Northern Cape, in KwaZulu-Natal, and in Limpopo.
Yeah, we've been tracking it very actively in terms of every single event since the 16th of June. So certainly, I think the interesting thing was that, you know, the lockdown, on many of the days, then there were long curfews where people couldn't go out. So that would definitely have an impact on the figures. I think one of the other elements, apart from the number of murders as opposed to attacks, is also the number of murders that are actually successfully prosecuted. So in Gauteng, for example, in the 6 month period of the end of last year, there were 65 attacks and 13 murders. But out of those, all of those attacks and all of those murders, there were only 3 arrests out of all of that. So you're looking at less than 5% or 4% of these farm murders actually result even in an arrest. And you can compare this to the highest conviction success rates in South Africa. If you look at the overall crime statistics, Murders, about 20% of them are normally solved. So there's a big issue, not only with the number of attacks, but how many of them are actually successfully prosecuted.
Well, that's actually a topic I want to touch on, because what gets lost in this for folks who are even paying even remote attention to what's happening in rural insecurity in South Africa is that that is a major problem. Not only are these attacks occurring and they're quite violent, often terroristic in many respects if you look at them, but beyond that, the criminal justice system, the police rarely arrest people. When they do arrest people, how many of these actually result in successful prosecutions? That number is also quite low. I read that you shared with Manzanzi, the agricultural site. I don't know if you were interviewed by them, but they're the ones who shared this when their press release. They said that you mentioned 20 attacks in rural Gauteng province, I think just in 2021, and only one arrest thus far. Is that accurate?
I haven't looked at their figures. Certainly, we've just seen the national crime statistics. And we've been trying to focus on correlating what's happening with the farm murders with the overall statistics. And the only way to really do it, we found, is to literally track and pick up each attack ourselves. Because it's so difficult to get an actual proper figure. And one of the reasons is the definition of a farm attack. So a farm attack, in technically speaking, is any attack, even on a small holding, which is a much smaller farm. As long as there's some agricultural activity going on there, that is still considered to be a farm. And then you have the element of rural attacks. Rural versus in South Africa, rural safety units, which we don't generally see out there. And part of the challenge we have with our crime statistics is that the crimes are aggregated to a precinct level. So for example, in my constituency, the Cullinan precinct there is 1,000 square kilometers. So that includes a lot of farmlands. It includes areas of wildlife reserves, and then also urban areas. So it's extremely difficult then to separate out the rural safety crimes from the urban crimes. And part of the reason why the Democratic Alliance has been calling for farm attacks to be a priority crime, that they are reported separately. Because to give you an example, in the time period of 16th of June to September, I asked a parliamentary question. And I asked how many farm attacks and how many farm murders were reported, and what were the statistics. And at that stage, we had 44 attacks, and the government came back and said that there were 4 attacks. So somehow they are missing a whole bunch of attacks, and they missed 8 murders out of those statistics. So there's something seriously wrong with this whole statistics. And many people are coming with different numbers. And this is why we're trying to actively get the news about the different attacks. We log them, we log what is happening, and then lit everyone up in batches to make sure that, and that where there are arrests, that they then go to court.
Well, when it comes to crime in South Africa, that's definitely a topic that bears attention. I remember when I worked a few years ago at a national intelligence agency here in the United States, when I was still in uniform, there was a period when the ANC simply stopped publishing crime statistics for nearly 2 years because it was just so horrific. And not only is that a violation of law, but that's a serious concern about transparency for the government. They restored reporting on it, but I think now people are just kind of inured to the violence. They really, it's astounding how, I don't want to say comfortable people become with it, but it reminds me of a trip to South Africa once. I was at Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris. We had a flight delay, and we were stuck in a terminal. All the shops were closed. And so these Americans were sitting there, and I was American. So they said, "So what's South Africa like?" I said, "No, it's brilliant. You'll love it. Just got to be careful, you know, when you're out traveling around, especially as a tourist, keep that spidey sense about you, you know, if something seems odd, it probably is odd." And South Africa's like, "Oh no, he's exaggerating. No, no, it's safe." Now, mind you, this is 21 years ago. And so they start talking about, "Oh yeah, yeah, no, that's when I was stabbed, when they tried to carjack me. And yeah, no, oh yeah, this is where I got shot when they broke into my home. And yeah, my sister, she was raped and murdered." Like, oh my gosh. And these are white, colored, and black South Africans. And they were just already by 2001 so accustomed to this violent activity that it's a bit a bit disturbing. I think people outside South Africa don't realize just how dangerous it can be in some places.
Yes, I know at one stage, I think it was last year or the year before, we were more dangerous than Iraq. It was more dangerous to live here than in Iraq.
That's pretty crazy. So we talked about the low number of prosecutions and arrests that take place here. What do you attribute this to? Do you think there are too few South African police service, too few SAPs, or are they too poorly funded, equipped, or trained? Is it the wrong focus? Because we know that farm murders and rural insecurity is not a priority focus, whereas cash and transit heist are, and gender-based violence. Or is it corruption? Or is it maybe a mix of all these things that lead to so few arrests and so few prosecutions?
Yeah, well, there's two main things that we've picked up and are working. And the one is certainly specialized police units. So from the 1990s, you used to have these commandos, and that were doing a lot of the rural safety and the rural patrols. Those were shut down in the late 90s, and really slowly but surely, our specialized police units are being shut down, and a police investigator is not a police investigator. Different areas and different types of crimes require specialist skills. And unfortunately, those are being lost with the loss of these special. And it sounds strange, but, you know, at one stage we realized that, for example, in that precinct I was talking about, that 1,000 square kilometers, when I went to go and visit the station commander, then I found out that they only had two vehicles for that entire precinct out of the 27 were running. So one of them was taking people to court in central Pretoria, which is our capital city. So that's what it was doing all day. And so there was literally one vehicle for 1,000 square kilometers. That's for visible policing and investigations. So you can imagine how difficult that's going to be. And I asked a more general question about Gauteng.
Connection's bad.
But the answer that there's 1,000. But when we worked it out, we worked out that let's say you have a reasonable amount of vehicles, like let's say 10% of your vehicles are in the service shop at any one time. If that was the case and you just had to get the rest back on board, you'd have an extra vehicle every 20 square kilometers in Gauteng. So that shows you what's sitting there in the shop.
The connection was cut off, so we missed the number. So I think you must have given a number of vehicles that are sitting idle because they're not maintained properly. Was that what you gave?
Yeah, so there were 1,407 vehicles.
Okay, wow, I didn't hear that. Wow, 1,407. Just in Gauteng, just with SAPs.
Okay, so to give you an example, there's about 5,000 that are in service. So let's say you had to take a reasonable amount. Or let's say 10% could be broken down or something at a time. That would still leave you with 800 to come back on board. Mm-hmm. And if you do the simple maths, it results in about one extra vehicle per 22 square kilometers in Gauteng, if those vehicles were just on the road.
If they were actually on the road.
It's a major, and apparently what is happening is that those vehicles go in, they go in for a radio or a broken mirror or something like that. And then the costs just escalate and they find more things and they find more things. And those vehicles end up staying there for a long, long time. And it just gets more and more expensive. So there is an element of corruption in that process as well, that we're busy trying to investigate and uncover. Why are 1,500 vehicles essentially, and I say it's an 18,000 square kilometer area, where you've got that many vehicles that are sitting in a shop. Something is seriously wrong there.
Well, I would have to
and
tell
so you.
You
have a situation, yeah.
As I said, I'd have to tell you that as a former Army officer and former non-commissioned officer before that, if one third of my vehicles were down for maintenance, I wouldn't be in a leadership position very long. That's all I got to say. Wow, that's pretty crazy. That is crazy. That's a lot of vehicles down. Maybe it's not a question of the resourcing. It's a question of management of those resources, because it sounds like they have enough vehicles.
Yeah, so the vehicles need to get back on the road. I mean, we're really putting the spotlight on that, and we're asking repeated questions about it, and we're going to look at what we can do about that. But also the specialization of the investigation, to really put a focus on that as well. you know, we have a situation, you know, sometimes it's also just a matter of process. So example with stock theft, what is happening is you could report an issue of stock theft. They might have an investigator that specializes in that, but you have to first report it to the police. So you cannot report it directly to an investigator to come out. And it can take a day or two before that person is even released to go and investigate that. So you can imagine by then,
they're long gone.
You know, time is the essence and the stock is long gone.
Yeah. Now that's when apartheid officially came to an end, we had the all race elections, Democratic elections, 27 April 1994. In advance of that, I was a young man, and I said that one thing that South Africa needs to focus on going forward, aside from a genuine national sovereign wealth fund, which they didn't do, but one thing they need to focus on is taking the police from being very effective at what they did during the National Party and during the apartheid time, and turn them into a community policing organization so that they provide security for all of South Africa. And that, of course, would involve properly training them, resourcing them, also a proper forensics, investigative detectives, all of those things that are necessary for law enforcement is something I encourage. And it seems like there was never any real push to do that. We've had a succession of people running the police who weren't police, often corrupt criminals like Jackie Salibe, who also ironically ran Interpol for a while, but also wound up as a prisoner in jail before his crimes. But it's probably not a healthy thing when you have a political, what's the word I want to say here? Political actor who runs your police service. And that's what you seem to have historically in South Africa since the new dispensation. Is there a lag, or is there a break in what I said?
Oh, there was a bit of a lag, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, I was just saying that it's difficult to, it's difficult when you have police forces that are run by political appointees, members who are put in charge or responsive, who are not law enforcement professionals that don't know criminal justice, and then they run it. We see people like Jackie Salibe, who was a criminal who ran SAPS, and we saw what happened to the quality of law enforcement during that time frame.
Well, this is where, you know, we had a briefing amongst all the Democratic Alliance community safety persons in the municipalities and our provinces. And one of the things that was coming out was definitely about this, the mentorship of investigators. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's one thing to say the fact that mentorship is not happening. And this was the view of somebody that was, you know, interacting with us to say that we'd asked about what we could do or how we could lobby to get these investigators, get these specialist units back. But they were saying that this is a major issue, that you used to have these specialized people and you would actually go out and you'd be a part of a team that would then learn from this person that had that expertise. And then you could take it over, and that kind of stopped. So it's not something that you just restart like a generator.
Yeah. No, these are the sort of skills. Well, I mean, this plays out in so many different professional fields. I mean, for instance, things as obscure as glass blowing. You know, there are furnaces in the United States and in Europe and in South Africa that have been lit for a century. They haven't been put out. You can't put them out because you can't restore them and bring them back. You have to start all over from scratch. That's the same sort of thing. And when it comes to professionalism, experience, when it comes to law enforcement, defense, medical fields, it's not simply, you know, like being an athlete. You took a few months off from an injury. Now you just work yourself back into shape. These are skills that are perishable that are critically important for law enforcement.
Yeah.
So now you are a member of the Democratic Alliance's focus group on farm attacks, and also something called the Watching Briefs Unit in Gauteng. Can you tell us about those two groups and what the role of them is?
Okay. Well, the focus group on farm attacks is really looking at this issue, which has largely been swept under the carpet over the years. So that, you know, the DA has had a number of initiatives over the years, but what happens is that there's an outcry, there's some sort of news reporting, and then it disappears. And then it comes back again every now and then. And it's something that we really believed it needs a consistent focus and a consistent pressure to get something done about it. And so part of that that working group really identified something that we, as the DA, have successfully implemented in the Western Cape, which was the court watching briefs. And what that was about was the situation where, as it is, there's not enough arrests happening, But once the arrests were happening, then the collection of evidence and the actual putting together of the case to prosecute, a vast majority of the time that was failing. And therefore, so even if you've caught the people, they would get away with it. And so in our constitution, it provides for the oversight over the police by provinces. And so certainly the Democratic Alliance in the Western Cape, who governs the Western Cape, they then implemented that, and they said they're going to perform a closer oversight over from arrest through the prosecution stage to ensure that these cases don't fall off the table. I think what, you know, and what happened is that we then said, well, let's form provincial units and look at our provinces in particular and see what we find from a regional point of view. And certainly from our learnings here in Gauteng, it was these other issues that came up as very urgent. I mean, if you've got three arrests, and typically, you know, they're under trial and things are going well, there's other structural issues that you need to look out for. But certainly the watching briefs has been very successful in the Western Cape in terms of from arrest, going all the way through, working with the police, working with the stakeholders to ensure that those crimes are indeed successfully prosecuted.
So here in the States, things are a bit different. We have people stand for office and you vote for the candidate, but in South Africa, you vote on a party list. And so it's a little bit different than what folks are accustomed to hear. But I'm curious, why did you enter politics? So a lot of people have a lot of different reasons for why they enter politics, but clearly you're in politics now, you're a member of parliament, and what drew you to it?
I was always in interesting kind of work where I could, interested in structural challenges and solving those. So I was actually in the geospatial analysis space where then there was a lot of work in terms of monitoring of projects, agriculture, environmental impact, all sorts of things, all the way through to police. So for example, command and control systems and that kind of thing. And so I'd always been interested in really making a difference, but in my private capacity then, I was also working with disabled children at their homes. And I found that over time, even though we did a lot of activity there, there was not a lot of interest in that from government. And, disabled people, disadvantaged people were really being neglected. And so that's when I started to lobby. They wanted to close some of these children's homes and homes for the disabled. They wanted to rationalize them. And it was just out of order. And so so I started lobbying the Department of Health and Social Development in Gauteng at that stage. And ultimately, we managed to keep those open. And, it's at that stage that I realized that I probably, yes, it's great to do charity work and do it at each home and build the networks around that home, build the support. But where my real passion was and where my skills were was more around, pushing issues at that level. That can make that broader difference. And so that's what really attracted me into politics. It wasn't for the money.
Well, I would hope not. I said there shouldn't be money in politics. But and without delving too deeply into Incandla, Oilgate, Travelgate, the arms deal, we won't get into any of that today. But that's not the reason I served in uniform in the Army. It certainly don't get wealthy being a soldier, that's for sure. Even as an officer, even as a colonel, you do well as a colonel, but not enough to come wealthy off of. So definitely wasn't for that. It was a calling. It sounds like you had a calling and you entered politics because government wasn't doing something you thought it should be doing or wasn't doing it correctly. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, I think it was about, being the voice for these people that didn't have their own voice. And there's so many people like that in South Africa. You know, there is a legacy of apartheid. Mm-hmm. It's not something that's going to get solved quickly. And it's many people that have been downtrodden and they don't have a voice. And the government is not listening to them. They're not they're not really trying as hard as they should be. And this is where we come in and fill the gap as the opposition party, is to really be public representatives. Helen Sussman was one of our founding fathers or mothers. Mm-hmm. And she always say, you've got to go out and see for yourself. You've got to go out and see for yourself. And that is certainly something that the Democratic Alliance really believes in. is getting onto the ground, being with the people, seeing what is going on there, and then bringing that back to Parliament to make a difference. And so, you know, that's why I found a home in the Democratic Alliance. It's exactly aligned to my way of thinking of what a politician and a public representative should be.
You mentioned Helen Suzman. She, for the longest time, was virtually the only voice in Parliament railing against apartheid. I think that people do South Africa's history a disservice when they forget about Helen Suzman. She doesn't get enough mention these days, and I think she deserves that, along with the Black Sash movement and others who fought against apartheid. But I appreciate you mentioning her. So when did you enter into politics? You saw that there was this need or that you could do something positive. When did you actually get into politics?
Oh, well, it was actually fairly recently. It was about 2014. Okay. So I've already been in official politics and party politics, because to be honest, I was very skeptical about it before then. when I was growing up, politicians were these gray-haired men with comb-overs, you know, and and they represented just about everything that was reprehensible, you know, and I've always been kind of
I don't think either you or I have a worry about a comb over, so we're good. Yikes. Well, that is rather recent. That's refreshing. I mean, I talked to so many politicians that have been doing it for 30 years, and I just like, oh, come on, go back to private sector or do something, then maybe come back. But so you've been in it for a short amount of time. Do you feel that you've been able to make a difference there in Gauteng, or has it been frustrating or rewarding, or maybe a little bit of both?
To digress, my parliamentary portfolio is home affairs. Mm. And certainly there are literally on a daily basis, I personally and people in the broader team are making a massive difference there, especially in the lockdown with people that were stranded at the borders, with their loved ones overseas, all sorts of regulations, lobbying. The great thing about that time was the amount of civil action that we managed to foster as well. You know, that special interest groups, let's say, for example, people that wanted to get back into South Africa or persons that didn't qualify under a certain ruling, to assist them to not only be their voice, but to assist them to mobilize and understand the different mechanisms of how you can hold government to account. You know, and that's certainly what we were able to do in that time. And there were many successes. So in terms of changes to the lockdown regulations, getting people back together. But at the moment, there's a big drive on the passport applications to reform that process. So that petition is coming through Parliament soon. And so certainly there's been very tangible changes and impact during the lockdown in specific, that I can refer to.
Well, speaking of the lockdown, you mentioned a lot of people have been downtrodden, certainly a legacy of the past, but I think we'd have to argue without any reservation that this COVID virus and the subsequent lockdown in South Africa have been very demoralizing for people. Millions of jobs lost, businesses collapsed, all sorts of strange things happening. Now a variant that supposedly comes out of South Africa, which is much more virulent. It's kind of put the kibosh on the AstraZeneca vaccine, as well as it's the other one now. It's Pfizer. Pfizer's also not doing as well. So they're relying extensively on the Johnson & Johnson as you get going. From a standpoint of people being downtrodden, I think South Africans have been beaten about as much as you can beat somebody. It's got to be frustrating.
Yeah, I think the Democratic Alliance was the first to really call out the government and say it's not just about lives, it's about livelihoods. Mm-hmm. We already came off a very low base going into COVID. And I think, you had to look at the rationality of some of the regulations that were made. And part of the problem was that our mechanism of choice of our government basically go into a room of certain people that went to make these decisions. And they put it in a mechanism that wasn't open to Parliament. And therefore you had a situation where these decisions were being made in secret. There wasn't scientific evidence for them. And you had just silly decisions. For example, people were not allowed to sell cooked chickens, for example. Or you had charities that were not allowed to hand out food. So at that stage, and I can tell you from my constituency, which includes a game reserve, I had reports of game getting shot for food. Mm-hmm. At that stage, you know, I had a campaign about to try and get people in general access to the food parcels. We got over 1,000 people that I got on the database for that. People that were desperate for food at that stage because they couldn't get out. Their livelihoods had been cut off. And at that stage, the government's approach was to say we're going to wait for 30 days and everyone must stay indoors and then we will roll out our plan. But instead of spending that 30 days working on the health response, they ended up spending it on setting up small businesses to raid the Solidarity Fund. That was funding of people that people put in from around the world and around the country to deal with a crisis. And so really it was just, it was shocking at that stage that, and what we found later on is that all that time that was taken, that we were sitting in lockdown, the economic opportunity frittering away was actually wasted.
Yeah, there was absolutely a lot of strange stuff happening back then, just to run through some of the famous hits since you've sort of alluded to them. Bans on e-commerce. If there's one thing that would reduce the spread of a virus, it would be e-commerce. If you don't have thousands of people rocking up at a shopping center and buying things because they're at home, then you have people in warehouses who are not in contact with other people for the most part, grabbing things off a shelf, putting it into a box, or even robots can do that. And then it's being shipped out and someone in the post delivering it. If you want to reduce a virus, e-commerce would be an ideal solution. And to hear the Minister of Trade, Ibrahim Patel, say that it was unfair to traditional retailers just made my jaw drop to the floor. If you have not created some sort of online presence anywhere in the world at this point for sales, even in the Congo, if you haven't got some kind of online presence, then you really probably shouldn't be in business. I mean, the first graphics-based browser for Mosaic came out in 1994. It's been a few days, and many businesses in business today didn't even exist in 1994. So to protect businesses that don't have an e-commerce presence is just nonsensical. So you had that, you had the ban on open-toed shoes, you had the tobacco ban, you had the alcohol ban. Some of them you could make sense. I mean, you know, let's be honest, a lot of South Africans love their drink and some misbehave when they drink. And so there's at least a logical argument, whether it's scientific or not, it's another story. But the tobacco ban, there are actually studies out of France that said that people were smoking actually were getting it less. And so they ignored that science and banned it. And Kozizani Dalimizuma in her famous Zol video, when people put this live on the paper, that's still funny. But the alcohol ban had, you know, idiotic, you know, downstream effects that they don't even think about. So South Africa is one of the world's top wine producers and exporters, and over half the profit from less than half the product, over half the profit comes out of shipping wine abroad. So what happens? You can't transport alcohol, so it couldn't get to ports and to airlines. They couldn't fly it abroad, and we couldn't get wine here in the States all of a sudden. And so you become an unreliable supplier. And then when the wholesalers want wine next time, they go to Australia or Chile. They don't come to South Africa. These things really made people scratch their head inside and outside South Africa. It must be very frustrating to be in Parliament and see a unelected, unaccountable body put together like the National Coronavirus Command Council making these decisions, which are just decisions. They're not anywhere in law. Did I miss something there?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Again, it was the lack of oversight. There was a call for oversight over the fund, for example. Mm-hmm. So the DA said right in the beginning that that Solidarity Fund, we need to have a parliamentary committee that's performing oversight over that. And that was rejected. And, you know, later on, that was a critical move that wasn't made because of the extent of the corona funding corruption that was going on.
Well, there was, you mentioned the Solidarity Fund. There was a lot of money donated by wealthy South Africans, the Rupert family. We also saw Patrice Motsepe and others donate a significant amount of money into these funds. And I'm still waiting for some transparency on that. There was another fund that was set up, a private fund that has some transparency, but the stuff that the government was running seems to be kind of opaque.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's been cases of PPE fraud in that, which is it's out in the open there. But you know, I don't want to digress too much. But yeah. You know, if you look at the Zondo Commission, for example, I mean, we have a ridiculous situation where there's so much evidence coming out, and you know, then the question comes, well, when are we going to prosecute these people? And then the answer is, well, no, we've first got to wait for the commission to be finished. And then we can start looking at the at prosecutions and that. So we have a situation where people were locked up for going surfing on the beach. They were locked up summarily without having to wait for the end of anything. And then you have these corrupt deployees that are rampant in South Africa that, I don't know, are they going to get their day in court? We don't know, because it seems to be all about kicking the can down the road. So as long as we can kick the can down the road and we have an investigation and we have a committee to decide whether there should be an investigation before a council decides on a symposium and then looks at some recommendations to another committee, you know, this is what is happening at the moment. And so we have literally hundreds of thousands of people that have been arrested for minor lockdown infringements. Not a single person arrested for corruption.
Yes, and of course, Sir Ramaphosa came into office as president, saying that he was going to stamp down on corruption, yet not a single arrest or high profile prosecution since he's become president. He keeps talking about corruption. He keeps saying it's wrong and we're going to do something, and we see nothing. We see, as you, again, not to get too far down the rabbit hole, but former President Jacob Zuma appeared November 19th. He got up and walked out of the Zondo Commission when he didn't like the questions they were asking. But then he was sent a summons to come in January. He ignored it. Sent another summons in February. He ignored that. Deputy Chief Justice Raymond Zondo has now gone for a warrant for his arrest and found him had a contempt of court. It's just utter craziness when it comes to prosecuting corruption in South Africa. It seems like the only people that are prosecuted are small fries that are not connected two cadres in the government. Just a statement from abroad here. That's how it looks from the outside.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, we, you know, the Democratic Alliance, I think it's really up to us to bring hope in the situation. And one of the approaches we're taking is, you know, the ANC government likes to make promises and they like to say flowery things. They like to make the right statements. And this year we're going to be holding them to account on that. So we're going to be tabling bills in Parliament, which contain a lot of what they've already promised, you know, the good things that we agree with. We're going to be taking those statements and those commitments, and we're going to be tabling them as bills. And we're calling out to, you know, if there are, you know, these so-called good people in the ANC, to come and vote with us to pass those bills, to bring the structural reforms that we need. And so I think, you know, this is the positive step that the DA is taking to say, well, all of these words and all of these promises that have happened, I think the new dawn has definitely been a false start. But that is our approach. It's to say that, you know, this is what we could be. We're putting it down as bills in Parliament, and that's going to be our approach this year, to call out the ANC government and say it's time to stop making these promises, flowery speeches with all these figures of speech and that. And let's get down to the nitty-gritty of it, because they're not putting these things on the table. And so it's not coming into law, and then it's not being enacted.
Now, a lot of South Africans who follow my program and those who I deal with around the world, colleagues and such, business colleagues, often lament that the ANC will never leave office, that people never vote against the ANC. But I make the argument to them that you're really not paying close attention to what's happening in South Africa. What I mean by that is specifically is that the ANC has already fractured twice since 1994, first with Terra Lakota and the creation of COPE, the Congress of the People, which took about 8.5% of the vote in that first election, but has kind of slid off the radar since then. Subsequently, Julius Malema from the Youth League was kicked out of the party and started his own party, the Economic Freedom Fighters. They splintered again, and they've gone from about 5% to about 10% of the electorate. Now, I personally think the EFF will cap out at 15%. I don't think they could get any more than that of the population vote for them. But the point is that the ANC has already fractured twice. In the 2019 national elections, they barely managed 57% of the vote nationwide. The Democratic Alliance, despite what I would term, this is my view, having lost its way and by external appearances trying to be like the ANC light, still managed to get around 21, 22% of the vote. I had hoped they'd go to 30 as an opposition party. But the point I'm getting at here is that when it comes to the ANC, people keep looking at things and they're thinking down the road. But assuming it goes forward, you have municipal elections this year. And the argument I make to a lot of people is that you win the opposition party needs to win an outright majority in Cape Town, in Nelson Mandela Bay, in Tshwane, in Joburg, and perhaps even in Durban as a possibility there. The ANC, in my view, and from those whom I know inside the party and outside the party, is wildly unpopular. They were unpopular because the path South Africa's on the past several years, but this lockdown has really made a lot of South Africans angry. And it seems to me an opportune time for opposition parties, whether it's the African Christian Democratic Party or the Inkatha Freedom Party or the DA or Freedom Front Plus, for these parties, this is a time to make your move. And I've been arguing that opposition parties should have been out on the ground, in the townships, in rural areas, in the cities, in the suburbs, winning people over to your argument since last summer. So that's a question. That was a long build up. My apology for that. But my question to you now, actually, here's a question here, not just a platform in Hyde Park. The question is the DA in Gauteng doing this? Because in 2019, the DA picked up a mix of voters, including about 16% of Black voters in Gauteng. Are you actually out there? Are you making progress in Gauteng? Because it's difficult to see from the outside. And I'm wondering if there's a grassroots or ground roots effort to draw people to your banner so that you can win in Joburg and in Pretoria, for example, outright.
Yeah, but I think firstly, you know, just looking at the, I think it's important to note that you know, sometimes there's a view that the DA or somebody has to get 50%, but actually the critical thing is to bring the ANC below 50%. And even though that often brings a time of turmoil, we're actually very close to that. If you look at the trajectory, you look at the latest by-election results. So the way that it was spun was that the DA had gone backwards and we'd lost X number of wards and things like that. Mm-hmm. But when you went and looked at the gross numbers, the DA had gone down by 0.8%, and the ANC had gone down by 8%. So that was an indicator for, certainly from our point of view, that the public is angry with the ANC and they are willing to demonstrate that at the ballot box. You know, if you look at the overall numbers there. Mm-hmm. So certainly the ANC has been on a continuous downward trajectory. Even with the new dawn, it still happened. Even with a good turnout that they had, that still happened. And so I think coming back to your question, you know, what we are focusing on the ground, certainly in the lockdown, the DA was the only party that was really out there taking on the ANC, making the hard calls, for example, about lives versus livelihoods. And in the beginning, John Steenhuisen was criticized for that statement, saying it was insensitive. But it was only about 2 months later that everybody was talking about lives and livelihoods. And the need for the balance of that. And so certainly on every major issue, the DA was driving the accountability on the COVID response. And then in the cities where we govern, you know, there has been that turmoil from not having an outright majority in those municipalities. But certainly during that lockdown period, the DA is a party through vehicles like DA Cares. So we were not allowed to go out and hand out food ourselves and that, but we created these networks with NGOs to make sure that food could go out there. And that's why we called called the ANC out on this ridiculous thing about NGOs not being able to distribute food at that time. I mean, obviously you need your safety measures, but that was just an outrageous situation where we stepped in. And because of that, people that were starving were able to get food. As we are, like where I'm staying in Tshwane, the capital city, the DA is now back in power there. And certainly there's a no-nonsense approach to service delivery that is going on in terms of the basics, you know, which we believe is making a very big difference. If you look at the top performing municipalities, in the top 10, they are DA municipalities. If you look at the bottom 10, it's ANC municipalities. So I think in the places where we govern, we are making that tangible difference. And where we can, we have certainly been engaging with stakeholders that are allowed to assist people and do that. And so, you know, with a combination of this, and like I said, with the by-election, you could see where the ANC went down, and we pretty much stayed stable in those those areas, and bearing in mind some of those areas that was again areas when a DA councillor had left under strange circumstances because of the contestation in those municipalities. So municipalities where the DA might have the most votes but doesn't have 50% plus one. Then there's a lot of approaches to individual councillors and things like that. So bearing in mind that background, the fact that we were stable and that the ANC went down, it certainly shows that that there's resilience there from the DA side, and that with the broader picture, we'll definitely do much better. But what we are calling for, again, is a government of unity for 2024 around values. So, you know, core values that, and if different political parties or individual actors subscribe to those values, then they are welcome to be part of a coalition. And then I know I've given a long answer, but just to add that...
it was a long question.
Yeah. It's also important to note there was a New Nation Movement judgment last year, and that compelled Parliament within a time frame to change the laws to allow independent candidates to stand for election. And so certainly that will definitely be in place by 2024, the next national election. And I think that will, you know, one can certainly see that you know, that effect that you were talking about, that fragmentation, where the ANC itself might not necessarily split up, they might hold together, that fragmentation might increase with independent candidates. It's just a fact of life.
Well, that certainly bodes well for people who have broader ambitions, although they're being kind of quiet about them right now, like Herman Mashaba. That ability to run as an independent candidate certainly bodes well for him. He's a known entity and name out there. It might pay off if he decides to run. But when people talk about coalitions, there's a lot of people in your party that talk about coalitions. And I grant you that coalitions can work. But my concern in South Africa's standpoint is that we've seen a coalition that suffered immensely because of, what's the best way to term this? I'll be polite. Partners that weren't committed to the same values that the DA was in Nelson Mandela Bay. You had a fantastic mayor in Athol Trollope. You had an amazing turnaround in that city from service delivery. The city was cleaned up. Things were improving dramatically. But that coalition was constantly under a threat as small parties with one or two representatives were part of the coalition and then threatened to pull away or actually pulled away and had trouble with the deputy mayor. And that's my concern with coalitions. That's why I'm arguing for South Africans to make your choice. And this may work to your benefit if any South Africans listen to me, because I'm telling them to go vote DA in 2021 for municipalities, because I think that a party needs to have an outright majority so that you're not subjected to the whims of a coalition partner that may or may not have genuine governance in mind. I've encouraged people to if they don't like the DA, suck it up, Buttercup, go vote for the DA in 2021 in municipal elections. Give them a chance to prove you they can run these municipalities well, and then see what happens. That's just been my advice to folks.
Yeah, I think you can't argue with the DA's track record in local government. It's shown time and time again. But I think a critical moment was it was late January when we entered into another round of load shedding, where Eskom put out a notice saying we regret that load shedding is happening again, etc. And the DA was able to put out a tweet saying, well, we don't regret that Stellenbosch municipality will no longer be load shedding, because they're completely independent of that. So they had completely resolved that issue. And you can be pretty sure that the residents are going to be very happy with that. And we're really in a situation now where I think people are going to need to start looking and saying, well, you know, from a municipal level, the Democratic Alliance is delivering, and we need that delivering. We see cities crashing around the country. There's the issue of Costa. Costa went to court and they won the court battle. And now they're starting to run their own municipal services and billing the council. So people definitely see that. And I believe that it's positive, certainly for us, for the next local government elections.
No, absolutely. It will be fascinating. A lot of people doubt that the municipal elections will take place in 2021. I certainly hope they take place. I think that the ANC, if they're paying any attention to it, is probably pretty nervous about 2021 municipal elections, because I think they're going to get shellacked. I honestly, I think that the ANC would be hard pressed to get 35% of the vote right now if we held a vote today. People are just that angry over cigarettes, tobacco, alcohol, shopping, cooked chicken, take your pick. People are really frustrated. And all the actions that the government has taken arguably haven't accomplished much of anything. Now, the President Raposo will pat himself on the back that they've done such a great job, but you have this virulent strain that's come about now. You sent the SANDF and you sent SAPs into the neighborhoods and the townships back in the early part of the lockdown. They killed 11 or 12 Black South Africans and then quickly pulled out of the townships, and people went about their business like it was nobody's business. It's no surprise that we have COVID still floating around South Africa. The measures they've taken have been ineffective at best, I would argue. So I think a lot of people are really frustrated, and the ANC is in trouble.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you just got to look at the general trajectory, even without COVID, was definitely going down and pointing towards a coalition government for 2024. So their actions and just the way that they've treated people as human beings in this lockdown and what they've allowed to happen will surely resonate with voters out there. Stealing grant money.
The relief money, the solidarity funds. It's the food parcel. I know people in South Africa, in KZN and in Gauteng, who were taking food out to poor people who were starving. You know, those townships north of Pretoria on the other side of the ridgeline over there, people taking food out there, and they were harassed, threatened with arrest, detained, and the food parcels were taken and they weren't delivered to anybody. You know where they went. They went right back to some corrupt official's place. Very heartbreaking here when South Africans who have the means and the compassion put themselves at risk by going out and delivering food to hungry South Africans. And it wasn't exclusively a white donating to Black, but it was heavily white South Africans donating to Black South Africans who were suffering, and also poor white South Africans. And it was really, really, I don't know what's the word I want to use here without being too, I guess, very annoying to hear that actually happened. But it happened to a number of people whom I know.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, we had that situation in my constituency. There were over 1,000 people that personally contacted me for the food relief. And we went through the official government channels to try and get these. And they could even experience what was going on. They understood that it was the ward councillor that was receiving these food parcels and giving it to their friends and family. So,
well, let me go ahead and we'll wrap up here in just a moment. A couple last questions for you. The reason I reached out to you was to talk about those farm murders in Babesfontein, and we did address that a little bit, and the rural insecurity that's taking place. But I did want to ask you this: for South Africans, I don't know if we've seen this sort of frustration or concern about the country to this degree since maybe the mid 1980s, with basically 9 months of many of the townships were ungovernable, and South Africa was under pressure from the world at that point. And a lot of people really down in South Africa, a lot of wealthy people left the country, money left the country. We find ourselves in 2021, and I'm not trying to draw a parallel to that time frame, but it seems to me that as many people are suffering or as unhappy as they were back in 85 as they are these days. Any thoughts on any light at the end of the tunnel? Is it going to get better, or what can South Africans do to make it better, other than vote for the DA? I'm sure you'll say that you want them to vote for the DA.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's so certainly in the context of the farm attacks and like I said, with the stock theft as well, there's a narrative in the country about taking land taking back what is yours and that sort of thing. And we're seeing that in there are a portion of the farm attacks that are opportunistic. It's just about persons being in a remote area and easy targets. But there's also then a lot of brutal attacks that are taking place. Certainly only a few days ago, there was a woman that was attacked and literally stabbed in the face. Hmm. It's just an outrageous action. And then there's areas of sort of Tshwane, the capital city, to the west of that, where there's these organized attacks. So you'll have six or seven attacks taking place within a few hours of each other overnight, where this is being arranged. Persons being arranged to take land and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so there's definitely a very negative move in the country that we are fighting in terms of the expropriation without compensation. We've had over 85,000 objections to that that have come in. I heard that today. But I think in reality, you know, what we're calling for the, with the farmer tax, for example, is, you know, we've put forward a community safety oversight bill. And what we're proposing there is more oversight by communities and more powers of community policing forums and farm watchers and that to have oversight over the police, but also to be equipped to start to help them help themselves and work with the police that are trying to help them. And let's not kid ourselves. I mean, it's not every single police person that's corrupt and lazy. You know, there's there are many that want to do something. They want to make a difference. And so, you know, we're coming with these bills and these proposals on how we can fix things, how we can fix this country. And I think, as I said before, what we're going to see over the next few months is the DA bringing all these positive proposals, mm-hmm. The promises that the ANC have made that we agree with, putting them in bills and putting them before the legislatures and saying, let's go forward. And putting the ANC in a position where they've got to say, well, we can't lie like this anymore. We can't kid the people. It's not going to fly. And ready to then... force positive change that way, or push positive change that way.
Well, listen, I do want to get something clear before we leave, because I didn't have to sort out a difficult surname like, I don't know, like Hoss or Chemes Hoss or something like that. It is Rus. That's easy to do. But I think I did mispronounce your first name. Do you go by Adrian or Adrian?
Adrian.
It is Adrian. Yeah. So I just naturally refer to it phonetically to Adrian. So Adrian, my apologies for that. But I just want to make sure. So Adrian Ruth. So I can make sure I got it straight before we left. So I want to thank you so much for coming on. My apologies that we had to switch to a different platform. Not quite as unfortunate as it was in my middle of my interview with Gary Gold. We were cut off, but thank you so much for coming on. And this video will be put up on other platforms so other people get a chance to see it. Some of those who watch my channel on YouTube until we get that sorted out. But thank you so much for your flexibility. You've been very patient and I appreciate it. Thanks for talking about these topics. And before we go, is there anything you'd like to share? Any message, you know, maybe something hopeful for people or a bright spot on the horizon? It's been a difficult 13 months with COVID. And I think that there isn't a place where it's been more difficult, arguably, than South Africa. People really, really suffered in South Africa over the decisions made over the last year and where we're at. So maybe some light at the end of the tunnel. Do you have anything hopeful to say? Not to put you on the spot.
Yeah. Well, I think an important thing, and like I mentioned about what happened in lockdown, where many people got engaged and they organized themselves. And yes, we assisted with that, but to actually to push their issue and to drive their issue. And really, you know, my encouragement would be to not sit on the sidelines and complain, but to be part of those people that write to your MP, write with solutions, rally against these injustices, that we can have a groundswell of people standing up and saying that this is not good enough. I found that, you know, we certainly found that in the lockdown, there were some situations, for example, with the tobacco ban, where mm-hmm. where many people were almost expecting the DA to litigate the tobacco ban, you know, which, and my encouragement would be to say that that we need every single person out there to obviously vote for the DA, vote for that change, go out there no matter what it takes to vote. Because those majority governments, when we've shown what we can do in Cape Town and in Midval with a majority government where we cannot be sabotaged. But very importantly, to participate in those parliamentary processes when a petition comes out about something, to sign the petition, when there's an issue coming out, to comment on the issue, to really participate in these processes so that we don't allow anything to be swept under the carpet.
Well, I think those are great comments, and I think you hit spot on there, Adrian. The key is to get involved, to do something, not just sit back and complain or just be agnostic about it. In the 2019 election, 17 million eligible voters in South Africa didn't vote. 17 million. And of course, in municipal elections, we're lucky to see 30 to 35% turnout, best case 39 to 40%. So it's a real opportunity, I think, in 2021 for opposition parties, whether it's a DA alone or in coalition, to wrest these municipalities from the ANC, the ones they don't have, and then show people you can govern and get their votes in 2024. So I think that's a good path ahead. Anyway, I want to thank you so much for being with me today. And it's really, thank you for your patience. This was a very unusual thing. You and I spoke just before we went on air. I was literally scrambling to download new software and try and move to different platforms to get the stream up because I didn't want to let you down after you agreed to come on. So thank you so much. And you're welcome to come back on the program. Hopefully we'll get YouTube sorted out. If we don't, I'll have a different platform. But thank you so much for being a guest today. I really appreciate it. And you have a lovely day and best of luck there in Gauteng with all that's happening.
Great. Thanks, Chris.
So my guest today was Adrian Roos from the Democratic Alliance in Gauteng province in South Africa. We were talking about farm murders, rural insecurity in South Africa. And then we kind of segued from that into just generally talking about the lockdown, what's happened, the prospects for political parties in South Africa, and prospect for South Africans going forward. And so there you go. That's kind of where we're at. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. Not many people are present, but I know a lot of people didn't know where the stream was. So thank you for tuning in. And we'll make sure we get the word out so you can find future streams until we sort out what's going on elsewhere. Anyway, folks, thanks a lot for listening to Chris White Africa.